Chapter 9. In the enormous whale belly of steel and stone carved out to form the long-enduring old opera house, Rick Deckard found an echoing, noisy, slightly miscontrived rehearsal taking place. As he entered, he recognized the music. Mozart's The Magic Flute, the first act in its final scenes. The Moor's Slaves, in other words, the chorus, had taken up their song a bar too soon, and this had nullified the simple rhythm of the magic bells. What a pleasure. He loved the magic flute. He seated himself in a dress circle seat. No one appeared to notice him, and made himself comfortable. Now Papageno, in his fantastic pelt of bird feathers, had joined Pamina to sing words which always brought tears to Rick's eyes, when and if he happened to think about it. Könnte jeder brave Mann solche Glocken finden, seine Feinde würden dann ohne Mühe schwinden. Well, Rick thought, in real life, no such magic bells exist that make your enemy effortlessly disappear. Too bad. And Mozart, not long after writing the magic flute, had died in his 30s of kidney disease and had been buried in an unmarked pauper's grave. Thinking this, he wondered if Mozart had had any intuition that the future did not exist, that he had already used up his little time. Maybe I have too, Rick thought as he watched the rehearsal move along. This rehearsal will end. The performance will end. The singers will die. Eventually, the last score of the music will be destroyed in one way or another. Finally, the name Mozart will vanish. The dust will have won. If not on this planet, then another. We can evade it a while, as the Andes can evade me and exist a finite stretch longer. But I get them or some other bounty hunter gets them. In a way, he realized, I'm part of the form-destroying process of entropy. The Rosen Association creates, and I unmake. Or anyhow, so it must seem to them. On the stage, Papageno and Pamina engaged in a dialogue. He stopped his introspection to listen. Papageno, my child, what should we now say?
Pamina,
the truth. That's what we will say. Leaning forward and peering, Rick studied Pamina in her heavy, convoluted robes, with her wimple trailing its veil about her shoulders and face. He re-examined the poop sheet, then leaned back, satisfied. I've now seen my third Nexus 6 android, he realized. This is Luba Luft. A little ironic, the sentiment her role calls for. However vital, active, and nice-looking, an escaped android could hardly tell the truth. About itself, anyhow. On the stage, Luba Luft sang, and he found himself surprised at the quality of her voice. It rated with that of the best, even that of notables in his collection of historic tapes. The Rosen Association built her well, he had to admit. And again he perceived himself sub specie eternitatis, the form destroyer called forth by what he heard and saw here. Perhaps the better she functions, the better a singer she is, the more I am needed. If the androids had remained substandard, like the ancient Q-40s made by Durain Associates, there would be no problem. And no need of my skill. I wonder when I should do it, he asked himself. As soon as possible, probably. At the end of the rehearsal when she goes to her dressing room. At the end of the act, the rehearsal ended temporarily. It would resume, the conductor said, in English, French, and German, in an hour and a half. The conductor then departed. The musicians left their instruments and also left. Getting to his feet, Rick made his way backstage to the dressing rooms. He followed the tail end of the cast, taking his time and thinking, it's better this way, getting it immediately over with. I'll spend as short a time talking to her and testing her as possible. As soon as I'm sure. But technically, he could not be sure until after the test. Maybe Dave guessed wrong on her, he conjectured. I hope so. But he doubted it. Already, instinctively, his professional sense had responded. And he had yet to err. Throughout years with the department. Stopping a super, he asked for Miss Luft's dressing room. The super, wearing makeup and the costume of an Egyptian spear carrier, pointed. Rick arrived at the indicated door, saw an ink-written note tacked to it reading, Miss Luft, private, and knocked. Come in. He entered. The girl sat at her dressing table, a much-handled cloth-bound score open on her knees, marking here and there with a ballpoint pen. She still wore her costume and makeup, except for the wimple. That she had set down on its rack.
Yes, she said, looking up.
The stage makeup enlarged her eyes. Enormous and hazel, they fixed on him and did not waver.
I am busy, as you can see.
Her English contained no remnant of an accent. Rick said, You compare favorably to Schwarzkopf.
Who are you?
Her tone held cold reserve, and that other cold which he had encountered in so many androids. Always the same. Great intellect, ability to accomplish much. But also this. He deplored it. And yet, without it, he could not track them down. I'm from the San Francisco Police Department, he said.
Oh?
The huge and intense eyes did not flicker, did not respond.
What are you here about?
Her tone, oddly, seemed gracious. Seating himself in a nearby chair, he unzipped his briefcase. I have been sent here to administer a standard personality profile test to you. It won't take more than a few minutes.
Is it necessary?
She gestured toward the big cloth-bound score.
I have a good deal I must do.
Now, she had begun to look apprehensive. It's necessary. He got out the Voight-Kampff instruments, began setting them up.
An IQ test?
No. Empathy.
I'll have to put on my glasses.
She reached to open a drawer of her dressing table. If you can mark the score without your glasses, you can take this test. I'll show you some pictures and ask you several questions. Meanwhile, he got up and walked to her and, bending, pressed the adhesive pad of sensitive grids against her deeply tinted cheek. And this light, he said, adjusting the angle of the pencil beam, and that's it.
Do you think I'm an android? Is that it?
Her voice had faded almost to extinction.
I'm not an android. I haven't even been on Mars. I've never even seen an android.
Her elongated lashes shuddered involuntarily. He saw her trying to appear calm.
Do you have information that there's an android in the cast? I'd be glad to help you. And if I were an android, would I be glad to help you?
An android, he said. Doesn't care what happens to another android. That's one of the indications we look for.
Then, Miss Luft said, you must be an android.
That stopped him. He stared at her.
Because, she continued, your job is to kill them, isn't it? You're what they call,
she tried to remember. A bounty hunter, Rick said. But I'm not an android.
This test you want to give me?
Her voice now had begun to return.
Have you taken it?
Yes. He nodded. A long, long time ago, when I first started with the department.
Maybe that's a false memory. Don't androids sometimes go around with false memories?
Rick said, my superiors know about the test. It's mandatory.
Maybe there was once a human who looked like you, and somewhere along the line you killed him and took his place. And your superiors don't know.
She smiled, as if inviting him to agree. Let's get on with the test, he said, getting out the sheets of questions.
I'll take the test, Luba Luft said, if you'll take it first.
Again he stared at her, stopped in his tracks.
Wouldn't that be more fair? She asked. Then I could be sure of you. I don't know. You seem so peculiar and hard and strange.
She shivered, then smiled again, hopefully. You wouldn't be able to administer the Voight-Kampff test. It takes considerable experience. Now please listen carefully. These questions will deal with social situations which you might find yourself in. What I want from you is a statement of response, what you do. And I want the response as quickly as you can give it. One of the factors I'll record is the time lag, if any. He selected his initial question. You're sitting watching TV and suddenly you discover a wasp crawling on your wrist. He checked with his watch, counting the seconds, and checked, too, with the twin dials.
What's a wasp? Luba Luft asked.
A stinging bug that flies.
Oh, how strange.
Her immense eyes widened with childlike acceptance, as if he had revealed the cardinal mystery of creation.
Do they still exist? I've never seen one.
They died out because of the dust. Don't you really know what a wasp is? You must have been alive when there were wasps. It's only been...
Tell me the German word.
He tried to think of the German word for wasp, but couldn't. Your English is perfect, he said angrily.
My accent, she corrected, is perfect. It has to be, for roles, for Purcell and Walton and Vaughan Williams. But my vocabulary isn't very large.
She glanced at him shyly. Vespa, he said. Remembering the German word.
Ach, yes, eine Vespe.
She laughed.
And what was the question? I forget already.
Let's try another. Impossible now to get a meaningful response. You were watching an old movie on TV, a movie from before the war. It shows a banquet in progress. The entree... He skipped over the first part of the question. Consists of boiled dog stuffed with rice.
Nobody would kill and eat a dog, Luba Luft said. They're worth a fortune. But I guess it would be an imitation dog. Ersatz, right? But those are made of wires and motors. They can't be eaten.
Before the war, he grated.
I wasn't alive before the war.
But you've seen old movies on TV.
Was the movie made in the Philippines?
Why?
Because, Luba Luft said. They used to eat boiled dog stuffed with rice in the Philippines. I remember reading that.
But your response, he said. I want your social, emotional, moral reaction.
To the movie?
She pondered.
I'd turn it off and watch Buster Friendly.
Why would you turn it off?
Well, she said hotly, who the hell wants to watch an old movie set in the Philippines? Whatever happened in the Philippines except the Bataan Death March, and would you want to watch that?
She glared at him indignantly. On his dials, the needles swung in all directions. After a pause, he said carefully, you rent a mountain cabin.
Yeah.
She nodded.
Go on, I'm waiting.
In an area still verdant.
Pardon?
She cupped her ear.
I don't ever hear that term.
Still trees and bushes growing. The cabin is rustic, knotty pine with a huge fireplace. On the walls, someone has hung old maps, Currier and Ives prints, and above the fireplace a deer's head has been mounted, a full stag with developed horns. The people with you admire the decor of the cabin, and
I don't understand Currier or Ives or decor,
Luba Luft said. She seemed to be struggling, however, to make out the terms.
Wait.
She held up her hand earnestly.
With rice. Like in the dog. Currier is what makes the rice Currier rice. It's curry in German.
He could not fathom for the life of him if Luba Luft's semantic fog had purpose. After consultation with himself, he decided to try another question. What else could he do? You're dating a man, he said, and he asks you to visit his apartment. While you're there...
Oh, nine, Luba broke in. I wouldn't be there. That's easy to answer.
That's not the question.
Did you get the wrong question? But I understand that. Why is a question I understand the wrong one? Aren't I supposed to understand?
Nervously fluttering, she rubbed her cheek and detached the adhesive disc. It dropped to the floor, skidded, and rolled under her dressing table.
Ach Gott, she muttered, bending to retrieve it.
A ripping sound, that of cloth tearing, her elaborate costume. I'll get it, he said, and lifted her aside. He knelt down, groped under the dressing table until his fingers located the disc. When he stood up, he found himself looking into a laser tube.
Your questions, Luba Luft said in a crisp, formal voice, began to do with sex. I thought they would, finally.
You're not from the police department. You're a sexual deviant. You can look at my identification. He reached toward his coat pocket. His hand, he saw, had again begun to shake, as it had with Polakoff.
If you reach in there, Luba Luft said, I'll kill you.
You will anyhow. He wondered how it would have worked out if he had waited until Rachel Rosen could join him. Well, no use dwelling on that.
Let me see some more of your questions.
She held out her hand, and reluctantly, he passed her the sheets.
In a magazine, you come across a full-page color picture of a nude girl.
Well, that's one.
You became pregnant by a man who has promised to marry you. The man goes off with another woman, your best friend. You get an abortion. The pattern of your questioning is obvious. I'm going to call the police.
Still holding the laser tube in his direction, she crossed the room, picked up the vidphone, dialed the operator.
Connect me with the San Francisco Police Department, she said. I need a policeman.
What you're doing, Rick said with relief, is the best idea possible. Yet it seemed strange to him that Luba had decided to do this. Why didn't she simply kill him? Once the patrolman arrived, her chance would disappear and it all would go his way. She must think she's human, he decided. Obviously, she doesn't know. A few minutes later, during which Luba carefully kept the laser tube on him, a large harness bull arrived in his archaic blue uniform with gun and star. All right, he said at once to Luba. Put that thing away. She set down the laser tube and he picked it up to examine it, to see if it carried a charge. Now what's been going on here? He asked her. Before she could answer, he turned to Rick. Who are you? He demanded. Luba Luft said, He came into my dressing room. I've never seen him before in my life. He pretended to be taking a poll or something, and he wanted to ask me questions. I thought it was all right, and I said okay, and then he began asking me obscene questions. Let's see your identification, the harness bull said to Rick, his hand extended. As he got out his ID, Rick said, I'm a bounty hunter with the department. I know all the bounty hunters, the harness bull said as he examined Rick's wallet. With the SF Police Department? My supervisor is Inspector Harry Bryant, Rick said. I've taken over Dave Holden's list now that Dave's in the hospital. As I say, I know all the bounty hunters, the harness bull said, and I've never heard of you. He handed Rick's ID back to him. Call Inspector Bryant, Rick said. There isn't any Inspector Bryant, the harness bull said. It came to Rick what was going on. You're an android, he said to the harness bull. Like Miss Luft. Going to the vidphone, he picked up the receiver himself. I'm going to call the department. He wondered how far he would get before the two androids stopped him. The number, the harness bull said, is... I know the number. Rick dialed, presently had the police switchboard operator. Let me talk to Inspector Bryant, he said.
Who is calling, please?
This is Rick Deckard. He stood waiting. Meanwhile, off to one side... The harness bull was getting a statement from Luba Luft. Neither paid any attention to him. A pause, and then Harry Bryant's face appeared on the vidscreen. What's doing? He asked Rick. Some trouble, Rick said. One of those on Dave's list managed to call in and get a so-called patrolman out here. I can't seem to prove to him who I am. He says he knows all the bounty hunters in the department and he's never heard of me. He added, he hasn't heard of you either. Bryant said, let me talk to him. Inspector Bryant wants to talk to you. Rick held out the vidphone receiver. The harness bull ceased questioning Miss Luft and came over to take it. Officer Krams, the harness bull said briskly. A pause. Hello? He listened, said hello several times more, waited, then turned to Rick. There's nobody on the line. And nobody on the screen. He pointed to the vidphone screen, and Rick saw nothing on it. Taking the receiver from the harness bull, Rick said, Mr. Bryant? He listened, waited. Nothing. I'll dial again. He hung up, waited, then redialed the familiar number. The phone rang, but no one answered it. The phone rang on and on. Let me try, Officer Krams said, taking the receiver away from Rick. You must have misdialed. He dialed. The number is 842. I know the number, Rick said. Officer Cram's calling in, the harness bull said into the phone receiver. Is there an Inspector Bryant connected with the department? A short pause. Well, what about a bounty hunter named Rick Deckard? Again, a pause. You're sure? Could he have recently? Oh, I see. Okay, thanks. No, I have it under control. Officer Crams rang off, turned toward Rick. I had him on the line, Rick said. I talked to him. He said he'd talk to you. It must be phone trouble. The connection must have been broken somewhere along the way. Didn't you see? Bryant's face showed on the screen, and then it didn't. He felt bewildered. Officer Crams said, I have Miss Luft's statement, Deckard, so let's go down to the Hall of Justice so I can book you. Okay, Rick said. To Luba Luft, he said, I'll be back in a short while. I'm still not finished testing you. He's a deviant, Luba Luft said to Officer Crams. He gives me the creeps. She shivered. What opera are you practicing to give? Officer Crams asked her. The magic flute, Rick said. I didn't ask you, I asked her. The harness bull gave him a glance of dislike. I'm anxious to get to the Hall of Justice, Rick said. This matter should be straightened out. He started toward the door of the dressing room, his briefcase gripped. I'll search you first. Officer Crams deftly frisked him and came up with Rick's service pistol and laser tube. He appropriated both after a moment of sniffing the muzzle of the pistol. This has been fired recently, he said. I retired in Andy just now, Rick said. The remains are still in my car up on the roof. Okay, Officer Crams said. We'll go up and have a look. As the two of them started from the dressing room, Miss Luft followed as far as the door. He won't come back again, will he, officer? I'm really afraid of him. He's so strange. If he's got the body of someone he killed upstairs in his car, Cram said, he won't be coming back. He nudged Rick forward, and together, the two of them ascended by elevator to the roof of the opera house. Opening the door of Rick's car, Officer Crams silently inspected the body of Polakoff. An android, Rick said. I was sent after him. He almost got me by pretending to be... They'll take your statement at the Hall of Justice, Officer Crams interrupted. He nudged Rick over to his parked, plainly marked police car. There, by police radio, he put in a call for someone to come pick up Polakoff. Okay, Deckard, he said then, ringing off. Let's get started. With the two of them aboard, the patrol car zoomed up from the roof and headed south. Something, Rick noticed, was not as it should be. Officer Crams had steered the car in the wrong direction. The Hall of Justice, Rick said, is north, on Lombard. That's the old Hall of Justice, Officer Crams said. The new one is on Mission. That old building, it's disintegrating. It's a ruin. Nobody's used that for years. Has it been that long since you last got booked? Take me there, Rick said. To Lombard Street. He understood it all now. Saw what the androids, working together, had achieved. He would not live beyond this ride. For him, it was the end, as it had almost been for Dave, and probably eventually would be. That girl's quite a looker, Officer Cram said. Of course, with that costume, you can't tell about her figure. But I'd say it's damn okay. Rick said, admit to me that you're an android. Why? I'm not an android. What do? Roam around killing people and telling yourself they're androids? I can see why Miss Luft was scared. It's a good thing for her that she called us. Then take me to the Hall of Justice on Lombard. Like I said, it'll take about 3 minutes, Rick said. I want to see it. Every morning I check in for work there. I want to see that it's been abandoned for years, as you say. Maybe you're an android, Officer Cram said. With a false memory, like they give them. Had you thought of that? He grinned frigidly as he continued to drive south. Conscious of his defeat and failure, Rick settled back and, helplessly, waited for what came next. Whatever the androids had planned, now that they had physical possession of him. But I did get one of them, he told himself. I got Polakoff. And Dave got two. Hovering over Mission, Officer Krams's police car prepared to descend for its landing. Chapter 10. The Mission Street Hall of Justice building, onto the roof of which the hover car descended, jutted up in a series of Baroque ornamented spires. Complicated and modern, the handsome structure struck Rick Deckard as attractive, except for one aspect. He had never seen it before. The police hover car landed, and a few minutes later, he found himself being booked. 304, Officer Cram said to the sergeant at the high desk. And 612.4. And let's see. Representing himself to be a peace officer. 406.7, the desk sergeant said, filling out the forms. He wrote leisurely in a slightly bored manner. Routine business, his posture and expression declared. Nothing of importance. Over here, Officer Cram said to Rick, leading him to a small white table at which a technician operated familiar equipment. For your cephalic pattern, Cram said. Ident purposes. Rick said brusquely, I know. In the old days, when he had been a harness bull himself, he had brought many suspects to a table like this. Like this, but not this particular table. His cephalic pattern taken, he found himself being led off to an equally familiar room. Reflexively, he began assembling his valuables for transfer. It makes no sense, he said to himself. Who are these people? If this place has always existed, why didn't we know about it? And why don't they know about us? Two parallel police agencies, he said to himself. Ours and this one. But never coming in contact, as far as I know, until now. Or maybe they have, he thought. Maybe this isn't the first time. Hard to believe, he thought, that this wouldn't have happened long ago. If this really is a police apparatus here, if it's what it asserts itself to be. A man, not in uniform, detached himself from the spot at which he had been standing. He approached Rick Deckard at a measured, unruffled pace, gazing at him curiously. What's this one? He asked Officer Krams. Suspected homicide, Krams answered. We have a body. We found it in his car, but he claims it's an android. We're checking it out, giving it a bone marrow analysis at the lab. And posing as a police officer. A bounty hunter. to gain access to a woman's dressing room in order to ask her suggestive questions. She doubted he was what he said he was and called us in. Stepping back, Cram said, "Do you want to finish up with him, sir?" "All right." The senior police official, not in uniform, blue-eyed, with a narrow, flaring nose and inexpressive lips, eyed Rick, then reached for Rick's briefcase. "What do you have in here, Mr. Deckard?" Rick said, "Material pertaining to the Voight Kampf personality test. I was testing a suspect when Officer Krams arrested me." He watched as the police official rummaged through the contents of the briefcase, examining each item. "The questions I asked Miss Luft are standard VK questions, printed on the..." "Do you know George Gleason and Phil Resch?" the police official asked. "No," Rick said. Neither name meant anything to him. "They're the bounty hunters for Northern California. Both are attached to our department. Maybe you'll run into them while you're here. Are you an android, Mr. Deckard? The reason I ask is that several times in the past we've had escaped Andes turn up, posing as out-of-state bounty hunters here in pursuit of a suspect." Rick said, "I'm not an android. You can administer the Voight Kampf test to me. I've taken it before, and I don't mind taking it again. But I know what the results will be. Can I phone my wife?" "You're allowed one call. Would you rather phone her than a lawyer?" "I'll phone my wife," Rick said. "She can get a lawyer for me." The plainclothes police officer handed him a 50-cent piece and pointed. "There's the vidphone over there." He watched as Rick crossed the room to the phone. Then he returned to his examination of the contents of Rick's briefcase. Inserting the coin, Rick dialed his home phone number and stood for what seemed like an eternity, waiting. A woman's face appeared on the vid screen.
"Hello," she said.
It was not Erin. He had never seen the woman before in his life. He hung up, walked slowly back to the police officer. "No luck?" the officer asked. "Well, you can make another call. We have a liberal policy in that regard. I can't offer you the opportunity of calling a bondsman because your offense is unbailable at present. When you're arraigned, however..." "I know," Rick said acridly. "I'm familiar with police procedure." "Here's your briefcase," the officer said. He handed it back to Rick. "Come into my office. I'd like to talk with you further." He started down a side hall, leading the way. Rick followed. Then, pausing and turning, the officer said, "My name is Garland." He held out his hand, and they shook, briefly. "Sit down," Garland said as he opened his office door and pushed behind a large, uncluttered desk. Rick seated himself, facing the desk. "This Voight Kampf test," Garland said, "that you mentioned." He indicated Rick's briefcase. "All that material you carry." He filled and lit a pipe, puffed for a moment. "It's an analytical tool for detecting Andes?" "It's our basic test," Rick said. "The only one we currently employ. The only one capable of distinguishing the new Nexus 6 brain unit. You haven't heard of this test?"
"I've heard of several profile analysis scales for use with androids, but not that one."
He continued to study Rick intently, his face turgid. Rick could not fathom what Garland was thinking.
"Those smudged carbon flimsies," Garland continued, "that you have there in your briefcase. Polakoff. Miss Luft. Your assignments. The next one is me.
Rick stared at him, then grabbed for the briefcase. In a moment, the carbons lay spread out before him. Garland had told the truth. Rick examined the sheet. Neither man, or rather neither he nor Garland, spoke for a time, and then Garland cleared his throat, coughed nervously.
"It's an unpleasant sensation," he said.
"To find yourself a bounty hunter's assignment all of a sudden, or whatever it is you are, Deckard." He pressed a key on his desk intercom and said, "Send one of the bounty hunters in here. I don't care which one."
"Okay, thank you."
He released the key. "Phil Resch will be in here a minute or so from now," he said to Rick. "I want to see his list before I proceed."
"You think I might be on his list?" Rick said.
"It's possible.
We'll know pretty soon. Best to be sure about these critical matters. Best not to leave it to chance. This info sheet about me," he indicated the smudged carbon, "it doesn't list me as a police inspector. It inaccurately gives my occupation as insurance underwriter. Otherwise, it's correct, as to physical description, age, personal habits, home address."
"Yes, it's me, all right."
"Look for yourself." He pushed the page to Rick, who picked it up and glanced over it. The office door opened, and a tall, fleshless man with hard-etched features, wearing horn-rimmed glasses and a fuzzy Van Dyke beard, appeared. Garland rose, indicating Rick.
"Phil Resch, Rick Deckard. You're both bounty hunters, and it's probably time you met."
As he shook hands with Rick, Phil Resch said, "Which city are you attached to?" Garland answered for Rick.
"San Francisco."
"Here, take a look at his schedule. This one comes up next." He handed Phil Resch the sheet which Rick had been examining, that with his own description.
"Segar," Phil Resch said, "this is you."
"There's more," Garland said. "He's also got Luba Luft, the opera singer, there on his list of retirement assignments. And Polakoff.
Remember Polakoff? He's now dead. This bounty hunter, or android, or whatever he is, got him, and we're running a bone marrow test at the lab to see if there's any conceivable basis."
"Polakoff, I've talked to," Phil Resch said. "That big Santa Claus from the Soviet police?" He pondered, plucking at his disarrayed beard. "I don't think it's a good idea to run a bone marrow test on him."
"Why do you say that?" Garland asked, clearly annoyed.
"It's to remove any legal basis on which this man Deckard could claim he hadn't killed anyone. He only retired an android." Phil Resch said, "Polakoff struck me as cold. Extremely cerebral and calculating. Detached."
"A lot of the Soviet police are that way," Garland said, visibly nettled.
"Luba Luft I never met," Phil Resch said, "although I've heard records she's made." To Rick, he said,
"Did you test her out?"
"I started to," Rick said, "but I couldn't get an accurate reading. And she called in a harness bull, which ended it."
"And Polakoff?" Phil Resch asked.
"I never got a chance to test him either." Phil Resch said, mostly to himself, "And I assume you haven't had an opportunity to test out Inspector Garland here."
"Of course not," Garland interjected, his face wrinkled with indignation.
His words broke off, bitter and sharp.
"What test do you use?"
Phil Resch asked. The Voigt Kampf scale.
Don't know that particular one.
Both Resch and Garland seemed deep in rapid professional thought, but not in unison.
I've always said, he continued, that the best place for an android would be with a big police organization such as WPO. Ever since I first met Polyakov, I've wanted to test him, but no pretext ever arose.
It never would have either, which is one of the values such a spot would have for an enterprising android.
Getting slowly to his feet, Inspector Garland faced Phil Resch and said, "Have you wanted to test me too?" A discreet smile traveled across Phil Resch's face. He started to answer, then shrugged, and remained silent. He did not seem afraid of his superior, despite Garland's palpable wrath.
"I don't think you understand the situation," Garland said. "This man, or android, Rick Deckard, comes to us from a phantom, hallucinatory, non-existent police agency allegedly operating out of the old departmental headquarters on Lombard. He's never heard of us, and we've never heard of him. Yet, ostensibly, we're both working the same side of the street. He employs a test we've never heard of. The list he carries around isn't of androids, it's a list of human beings. He's already killed once. At least once. And if Miss Luft hadn't gotten to a phone, he probably would have killed her, and then eventually he would have come sniffing around after me."
"Hmm," Phil Resch said.
"Hmm,"
Garland mimicked, wrathfully. He looked now as if he bordered on apoplexy. "Is that all you have to say?" The intercom came on and a female voice said,
"Inspector Garland, the lab report on Mr. Polyakov's corpse is ready."
"I think we should hear it," Phil Resch said.
Garland glanced at him, seething. Then he bent, pressed the key of the intercom.
"Let's have it, Miss French." "The bone marrow test," Miss French said, "shows that Mr. Polyakov was a humanoid robot. Do you want a detailed—"
"No, that's enough."
Garland settled back in his seat, grimly contemplating the far wall. He said nothing to either Rick or Phil Resch. Resch said, "What is the basis of your Voigt Kampf test, Mr. Deckard?" "Empathic response. In a variety of social situations, mostly having to do with animals."
"Ours is probably simpler," Resch said. "The reflex arc response taking place in the upper ganglia of the spinal column requires several microseconds more in the humanoid robot than in a human nervous system."
Reaching across Inspector Garland's desk, he plucked a pad of paper toward him. With a ballpoint pen, he drew a sketch.
"We use an audio signal or a light flash. The subject presses a button and the elapsed time is measured. We try it a number of times, of course. Elapsed time varies in both the Andy and the human. But by the time 10 reactions have been measured, we believe we have a reliable clue. And, as in your case with Polyakov, the bone marrow test backs us up."
An interval of silence passed, and then Rick said, "You can test me out. I'm ready. Of course, I'd like to test you too, if you're willing."
"Naturally," Resch said.
He was, however, studying Inspector Garland.
"I've said for years," Resch murmured, "that the Bonelli reflex arc test should be applied routinely to police personnel. The higher up the chain of command, the better. Haven't I, Inspector?"
"That's right," You have, Garland said. And I've always opposed it. On the grounds that it would lower department morale.
I think now, Rick said, you're going to have to sit still for it. In view of your lab's report on Polyakov.
Chapter 11. Garland said, I guess so. He jabbed a finger at the bounty hunter Phil Resch. But I'm warning you, you're not going to like the results of the tests.
Do you know what they'll be? Resch asked with visible surprise. He did not look pleased.
I know almost to a hair, Inspector Garland said.
Okay. Resch nodded. I'll go upstairs and get the Benelli gear. He strode to the door of the office, opened it, and disappeared out into the hall. I'll be back in 3 or 4 minutes, he said to Rick. The door shut after him.
Reaching into the right-hand top drawer of his desk, Inspector Garland fumbled about, then brought forth a laser tube. He swiveled it until it pointed at Rick.
That's not going to make any difference, Rick said. Resch will have a post-mortem run on me, the same as your lab ran on Polyakov. And he'll still insist on a, what did you call it, Benelli reflex arc test on you and on himself. The laser tube remained in its position, and then Inspector Garland said,
It was a bad day all day. Especially when I saw Officer Krams bringing you in. I had an intuition. That's why I intervened.
By degrees, he lowered the laser beam. He sat gripping it, and then he shrugged and returned it to the desk drawer, locking the drawer and restoring the key to his pocket.
What will tests on the three of us show? Rick asked.
Garland said, That damn fool, Resch.
He actually doesn't know?
He doesn't know. He doesn't suspect. He doesn't have the slightest idea. Otherwise, he couldn't live out a life as a bounty hunter. A human occupation. Hardly an android occupation.
Garland gestured toward Rick's briefcase.
Those other carbons, the other suspects you're supposed to test and retire? I know them all.
He paused, then said,
We all came here together on the same ship from Mars.
Not Resch. He stayed behind another week, receiving the synthetic memory system.
He was silent then. Or rather, it was silent.
Rick said, What'll he do when he finds out?
I don't have the foggiest idea, Garland said remotely. It ought, from an abstract intellectual viewpoint, to be interesting. He may kill me, kill himself. Maybe you too. He may kill everyone he can, human and android alike. I understand that such things happen when there's been a synthetic memory system laid down, when one thinks it's human.
So when you do that, you're taking a chance.
Garland said, It's a chance anyway, breaking free and coming here to Earth, where we're not even considered animals. Where every worm and woodlouse is considered more desirable than all of us put together.
Irritably, Garland picked at his lower lip.
Your position would be better if Phil Resch could pass the Benelli test, if it was just me. The results that way would be predictable.
To Resch, I'd just be another Andy to retire as soon as possible.
So you're not in a good position either, Deckard. Almost as bad, in fact, as I am. You know where I guessed wrong? I didn't know about Polakoff. He must have come here earlier. Obviously, he came here earlier. In another group entirely. No contact with ours. He was already entrenched in the WPO when I arrived. I took a chance on the lab report, which I shouldn't have. Krams, of course, took the same chance.
Polakoff was almost my finish, too, Rick said.
Yes, there was something about him. I don't think he could have been the same brain unit type as we. He must have been souped up or tinkered with. An altered structure, unfamiliar even to us. A good one, too. Almost good enough.
When I phoned my apartment, Rick said, why didn't I get my wife?
All our vid phone lines here are trapped. They recirculate the call to other offices within the building. This is a homeostatic enterprise we're operating here, Deckard. We're a closed loop cut off from the rest of San Francisco. We know about them, but they don't know about us. Sometimes an isolated person such as yourself wanders in here, or, as in your case, is brought here for our protection.
He gestured convulsively toward the office door.
Here comes eager beaver Phil Resch back with his handy-dandy portable little test. Isn't he clever? He's going to destroy his own life and mine, and possibly yours.
You androids, Rick said, don't exactly cover for each other in times of stress.
Garland snapped, I think you're right. It would seem we lack a specific talent you humans possess. I believe it's called empathy.
The office door opened. Phil Resch stood outlined, carrying a device which trailed wires. Here we are, he said, closing the door after him. He seated himself, plugging the device into the electrical outlet. Bringing out his right hand, Garland pointed at Resch. At once, Resch, and also Rick Deckard, rolled from their chairs and onto the floor. At the same time, Resch yanked a laser tube and, as he fell, fired at Garland. The laser beam, aimed with skill, based on years of training, bifurcated Inspector Garland's head. He slumped forward, and from his hand, his miniaturized laser beam rolled across the surface of his desk. The corpse teetered on its chair, and then, like a sack of eggs, it slid to one side and crashed to the floor. It forgot, Resch said, rising to his feet, that this is my job. I can almost foretell what an android is going to do. I suppose you can, too. He put his laser beam away, bent, and with curiosity examined the body of his quondam superior.
What did it say to you while I was gone?
That he... it was an android. And you... Rick broke off, the conduits of his brain humming, calculating, and selecting. He altered what he had started to say.
Would detect it, he finished.
In a few more minutes.
Anything else?
This building is android infested.
Resch said introspectively, that's going to make it hard for you and me to get out of here. Nominally, I have the authority to leave any time I want, of course. And to take a prisoner with me.
He listened. No sound came from beyond the office.
I guess they didn't hear anything. There's evidently no bug installed here, monitoring everything. As there should be.
Gingerly, he nudged the body of the android with the toe of his shoe.
It certainly is remarkable, the psionic ability you develop in this business. I knew before I opened the office door that he would take a shot at me. Frankly, I'm surprised he didn't kill you while I was upstairs.
He almost did, Rick said. He had a big utility model laser beam on me part of the time. He was considering it, but it was you he was worried about, not me.
The android flees, Resch said humorlessly, where the bounty hunter pursues.
You realize, don't you, that you're going to have to double back to the opera house and get Luba Luft before anyone here has a chance to warn her as to how this came out? Warn it, I should say. Do you think of them as it?
I did at one time, Rick said, when my conscience occasionally bothered me about the work I had to do. I protected myself by thinking of them that way, but now I no longer find it necessary. All right, I'll head directly back to the opera house, assuming you can get me out of here.
Suppose we sit Garland up at his desk, Resch said. He dragged the corpse of the android back up into its chair, arranging its arms and legs so that its posture appeared reasonably natural, if no one looked closely, if no one came into the office. Pressing a key on the desk intercom, Phil Resch said, Inspector Garland has asked that no calls be put through to him for the next half hour. He's involved in work that can't be interrupted.
Yes, Mr. Resch.
Releasing the intercom key, Phil Resch said to Rick, I'm going to handcuff you to me during the time we're still here in the building. Once we're airborne, I'll naturally let you go. He produced a pair of cuffs, slapped one onto Rick's wrist and the other around his own.
Come on. Let's get it over with.
He squared his shoulders, took a deep breath, and pushed open the office door. Uniformed police stood or sat on every side, conducting their routine business of the day. None of them glanced up or paid any attention as Phil Resch led Rick across the lobby to the elevator.
What I'm afraid of, Resch said as they waited for the elevator, is that the Garland one had a dead man's throttle warning component built into it. But, he shrugged, I would have expected it to go off by now. Otherwise, it's not much good.
The elevator arrived. Several police-like nondescript men and women disem-elevatored, clacked off across the lobby on their several errands. They paid no attention to Rick or Phil Resch.
Do you think your department will take me on? Resch asked as the elevator doors shut, closing the two of them inside.
He punched the roof button and the elevator silently rose.
After all, as of now, I'm out of a job, to say the least.
Guardedly, Rick said, I don't see why not. Except that we already have two bounty hunters.
I've got to tell him, he said to himself.
It's unethical and cruel not to.
Mr. Resch, you're an android, he thought to himself. You got me out of this place, and here's your reward. You're everything we jointly abominate. The essence of what we're committed to destroy.
I can't get over it, Phil Resch said. It doesn't seem possible. For 3 years, I've been working under the direction of androids. Why didn't I suspect? I mean, enough to do something.
Maybe it isn't that long. Maybe they only recently infiltrated this building.
They've been here all the time.
Garland has been my superior from the start, throughout my 3 years.
According to it, Rick said, the bunch of them came to Earth together.
and that wasn't as long ago as 3 years. It's only been a matter of months.
Then at one time an authentic Garland existed, Phil Rash said, and somewhere along the way got replaced.
His shark-like lean face twisted, and he struggled to understand.
Or, I've been impregnated with a false memory system. Maybe I only remember Garland over the whole time.
But
his face, suffused now with growing torment, continued to twist and work spasmodically.
Only androids show up with false memory systems. It's been found ineffective in humans.
The elevator ceased rising. Its doors slid back, and there, spread out ahead of them, deserted except for empty parked vehicles, lay the police station's roof field.
Here's my car, Phil Rash said, unlocking the door of a nearby hover car and waving Rick rapidly inside.
He himself got in behind the wheel and started up the motor. In a moment, they had lifted into the sky and, turning north, headed back in the direction of the War Memorial Opera House. Preoccupied, Phil Rash drove by reflex. His progressively more gloomy train of thought continued to dominate his attention.
Listen, Deckard, he said suddenly. After we retire Luba Luft, I want you to...
His voice, husky and tormented, broke off.
You know, give me the Benelli test, or that empathy scale you have, to see about me.
We can worry about that later, Rick said evasively.
You don't want me to take it, do you?
Phil Rash glanced at him with acute comprehension.
I guess you know what the results will be.
Garland must have told you something.
Facts which I don't know.
Rick said, it's going to be hard even for the two of us to take out Luba Luft. She's more than I could handle anyhow. Let's keep our attention focused on that.
It's not just false memory structures, Phil Rash said. I own an animal.
Not a false one, but the real thing.
A squirrel.
I love the squirrel, Deckard. Every goddamn morning I feed it and change its papers. You know, clean up its cage. And then in the evening when I get off work, I let it loose in my apt and it runs all over the place. It has a wheel in its cage. Ever seen a squirrel running inside a wheel? It runs and runs. The wheel spins, but the squirrel stays in the same spot. Buffy seems to like it, though.
I guess squirrels aren't too bright, Rick said. They flew on then, in silence. Chapter 12. At the opera house, Rick Deckard and Phil Rash were informed that the rehearsal had ended, and Miss Luft had left.
Did she say where she intended to go?
Phil Rash asked the stagehand, showing his police identification.
Over to the museum.
The stagehand studied the ID card.
She said she wanted to take in the exhibit of Edvard Munch that's there now. It ends tomorrow.
And Luba Luft, Rick thought to himself, ends today. As the two of them walked down the sidewalk to the museum, Phil Rash said,
What odds will you give?
She's flown. We won't find her at the museum.
Maybe, Rick said. They arrived at the museum building, noted on which floor the Munch exhibit could be found, and descended. Shortly, they wandered amid paintings and woodcuts. Many people had turned out for the exhibit, including a grammar school class.
The shrill voice of the teacher penetrated all the rooms comprising the exhibit, and Rick thought, that's what you'd expect an Andy to sound and look like, instead of like Rachel Rosen and Luba Luft, and the man beside him, or rather, the thing beside him. Did you ever hear of an Andy having a pet of any sort? Phil Resch asked him. For some obscure reason, he felt the need to be brutally honest. Perhaps he had already begun preparing himself for what lay ahead. In two cases that I know of, Andy's owned and cared for animals. But it's rare. From what I've been able to learn, it generally fails. The Andy is unable to keep the animal alive. Animals require an environment of warmth to flourish. Except for reptiles and insects.
Would a squirrel need that?
An atmosphere of love? Because Buffy is doing fine. As sleek as an otter. I groom and comb him every other day. At an oil painting, Phil Resch halted, gazed intently. The painting showed a hairless, oppressed creature with a head like an inverted pear, its hands clapped in horror to its ears, its mouth open in a vast, soundless scream. Twisted ripples of the creature's torment, echoes of its cry, flooded out into the air surrounding it. The man or woman, whichever it was, had become contained by its own howl. It had covered its ears against its own sound. The creature stood on a bridge, and no one else was present. The creature screamed in isolation, cut off by, or despite, its outcry. He did a woodcut of this, Rick said, reading the card tacked below the painting.
I think, Phil Resch said, that this is how an Andy must feel.
He traced in the air the convolutions visible in the picture of the creature's cry.
I don't feel like that.
So maybe I'm not an... He broke off as several persons strolled up to inspect the picture. There's Luba Luft. Rick pointed and Phil Resch halted his somber introspection and defense. The two of them walked at a measured pace toward her, taking their time as if nothing confronted them. As always, it was vital to preserve the atmosphere of the commonplace. Other humans, having no knowledge of the presence of androids among them, had to be protected at all costs, even that of losing the quarry.